WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. When the Taliban fled Kabul in November of 2001, international observers celebrated it as a victory for freedom, for Afghan women in particular. But 2.5 years later, women are still wearing burqas, and female suicide rates appear to be on the rise. Tonight on Point, how far women have come in post-Taliban Afghanistan, and how far they still have to go. But first, just days after the U.S. warned Saudi officials of a possible terrorist attack and told non-essential American personnel to leave, a suicide car bomb blasted the National Police headquarters in Riyadh. The entire front of the five-story building was shattered, and burned-out cars littered the area. At the time of the blast, the building was filled with workers, but there's been no official word from the Saudi government on the number of casualties. Faiza Amba is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor in Saudi Arabia. I asked her about the big-picture significance of today's attack.
What's very interesting about today's attack is that it's the first time in the past year, the first attacks by suspected al-Qaeda militants was last May. The other two targets have been Western housing compounds. So this is the first attack that is on a purely Saudi and security target.
And, of course, the first assumption is that this was the work of al-Qaeda. Has there been any claim of responsibility or perhaps additional evidence as to who might be responsible?
Al-Qaeda militants have been under heavy attack over the past week, and they have promised to get back at the Saudi security forces. Last month, the supposed leader of Al-Qaeda was killed in a shootout. Five truck bombs have been defused over the past week. Eight suspects have been arrested. There's been a very heavy crackdown on Al-Qaeda over the past week, and it's believed that this is a response to that.
Well, and also, as you know, Washington ordered non-essential officials home from Saudi Arabia last week because of signs that more attacks like this one were anticipated. How tight has security become over the past few weeks?
In the space of 1 week, six security officers were killed in and around the Riyadh area. There's been a massive manhunt. They've been looking for suspects. They've been looking for the people that were involved in the shootout of the six in separate incidents of the six police officers. So the security crackdown over the past 10 days has been very heavy. They've said they found the truck bombs, they found cash, they found disguises, they found women's black veils and the black cloaks. Women were in Saudi Arabia. They found those in the hideout that the suspects had been using as disguises. Since May, there have been periods where the security forces have gone on in massive crackdowns, and these past 2 weeks has been one of them.
And is there widespread public support for this kind of crackdown, or is there some sympathy for the people who are doing these things against the government and against Western interests?
I spoke to several analysts last week when we noticed that there's a list of 26 militants. There's a $1.9 million reward for foiling terrorist attacks. There are booklets, thousands of booklets handed out looking for these people. And yet, the people that are involved in the shootouts and the people that are dying and being arrested, a lot of the time have not been among these 26 suspects, which leads us to believe that either al-Qaeda is getting new recruits or that they're getting some form of support and help. They're hiding out. They still have cash. They still have weapons. So it's obvious that there's some support and sympathy for them. The other thing is that a lot of Saudis, are reacting to what's going on in Palestine and Iraq. They don't really have a way of expressing it here in Saudi Arabia. The reform process is very slow. So you've got a situation where you have, man on the street is unhappy about what's going on in the region, doesn't have a way of expressing it. So I guess it makes it easier for some of these extremist groups to gain recruits.
In other words, people don't seem to be really inclined to turn them in.
People don't seem inclined to turn them in. Some people see the Saudi government as allies of the United States. There's a lot of anti-American feelings. And the fact that you don't have a way in Saudi Arabia of expressing these feelings, you can't really show opposition. There are no real reforms. So you've got a vicious cycle.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks, Gail. Take care.
Faiza Amba is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. the fall of 2001, Americans were flooded with images of women under the Taliban. Shrouded in burqas, always accompanied by a male relative, Afghan women were the very picture of oppression. The fall of the Taliban was hailed as the liberation of Afghan women. "Afghan women are free," proclaimed George W. Bush in his 2002 State of the Union address. But now, 2.5 years later, women and girls in Afghanistan still suffer many of the human rights abuses they did under the old regime, and female suicide rates appear to be on the rise. French philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy, founder of a French-Afghan monthly magazine, recently wrote about the tragic death of Homa Safi, a young Afghan woman journalist who committed suicide after being forbidden to marry the man she loved. When I spoke with Bernard-Henri earlier today, I asked him to tell me more about Homa.
She was working as a journalist in the newspaper which I created and which I direct in Afghanistan. This newspaper was created 2 years ago. It is called Les Nouvelles de Kaboul. It has the peculiarity to be made half by foreigners, and especially French, and half by Afghan-speaking writers. And Homa was one of these Afghan-speaking writers. She was a bright young girl, very well learned, very clever. She was beautiful. She had admirable green eyes. She wore a little scarf around her head, but not a burqa, of course, a little scarf. And this terrible story happened.
And it began when she fell in love.
It began by love, yeah. She fell in love with a young boy of her age. And as any young girl, she was so much in love that she wanted to live with him and to marry him. As she was a good girl and a good child, full of respect to her fathers, she brought this boy to her family. And the family of the boy asked her hand to her family, and the father of Homa refused.
Why so?
He refused for two reasons. First reason, because the boy was Shia and Homa's family was Sunni. And the second reason, even more terrible, is that the father had already promised Homa to the son of another family. So he said no. Homa was despaired. She did not know what to do, to escape, but where, to go where, to refuse, impossible in the Afghan tradition, to revolt, impossible in the Afghan tradition. So she asked an advance on her salary. She went to a drugstore to buy some medicines. She came to her job for the last time a few days ago. She took the medicines and she committed suicide. She died. She died for love. She died because a stupid father and the traditional way of thinking prevented her to marry the boy of her heart.
What does her father say now?
This is, in a way, part of the pitiful story. The father, of course, is sad, more than sad, destroyed. And he says, if I had known that my little Homa could commit such a gesture, I would not have said no. I would have allowed her to marry whoever she wants, even a Shia, even somebody of another family. He's a stupid man, of course, but he's not a villain. He's just a stupid, narrow-minded father. But Homa died not because of the villainy, but because of the stupidity of integrism. The father regrets today. I spoke with him, of course, since this happened. I discovered that this stupid man, prisoner of his own tradition, was also very proud of the new job of his daughter. For instance, Homa wrote for us a very good piece about the situation of Afghan women, about the necessary freedom which they had to conquer. And the father was glad of that. He was proud of that. Sometimes he and his wife saw the light very late in the room of Homa. And the father said, our little Homa is writing for this new newspaper, this new job. We are so proud. But his pride did not go unto the point of giving her the liberty she deserved.
Well, and in part because of her work. What do you think her expectations were for her life as a woman in a post-Taliban world?
As all the young women in Afghanistan, she hoped to get liberty, freedom, democracy. She hoped to live as you live yourself and all the women, American women who listen to us. The women of Afghanistan think that liberty is not reserved to Westerners, that there is not a fatality which forbids one half of the humanity to get the benefits of democracy. She wanted democracy, and she loved her job. We are all of us so sad, so full of tears.
Understandably so. But are stories like Homa's very unusual in Afghanistan today?
I fear not. You have, unfortunately, many cases like that. Last year, 100 of cases were reported in only one province, the province of Herat, near the Iranian border. This province, which master is the warlord Ismail Khan. More than 100 cases were reported of women who burnt themselves to death in order to escape to a forced marriage, a forced wedding, because they just wanted, like any young Westerner, to choose their destiny.
And this also seems so shocking to many of us in the West, because Afghanistan is being portrayed frequently, at least we hear this from our president, that it is the success story, that things are much better for everyone, and particularly for women, since the Taliban has been overthrown.
Afghanistan is not this paradise. It is not the success story which is presented to us, and it is not because we do not do enough. We, Westerners, Europe and America, we do not do all that we promised. We made some promises and we did not hold them. This is one thing which is very shocking for my friends in Afghanistan. They come to me and to us. You promised. Where are the results of your promises?
In your writing, you pose the question of what responsibility do Westerners and non-governmental organizations have who speak of freedom and equality. I wonder, do you have an answer to that question?
Yes, I have. It's a difficult question because, of course, you cannot avoid raising the question. Maybe we gave some hope and we are not able to achieve the hope. Maybe we promised too much according to what we are able to reach. Maybe we leave these young girls in the middle of the road. We bring them on the road of democracy and we are abandoning them after a few steps. What should we do? Not bringing them at all on the road of democracy, or keeping their hand in our hand much longer than we do? My answer is the second one. The death of Homa is not an invitation to do less, but is an exhortation to do more, much more.
Thank you. It is truly quite a story, and you write about it beautifully.
Thank you very much.
Bernard-Henri Lévy is the author of the forthcoming book, War, Evil, and the End of History. He spoke with me today from New York. We're talking this hour about the status of women in Afghanistan 2.5 years after the fall of the Taliban. Are you satisfied with the progress Afghan women have made, or surprised that they're not further along? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the status of women in Afghanistan, 2.5 years after the fall of the Taliban. On Monday, President Bush offered his take on Afghan women's freedom while campaigning with Senator Arlen Specter in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
The Taliban had a perverted view of the world. They must have hated women. Women were given no rights. Young girls did not go to school. It was a barbaric regime. So not only did we uphold doctrine that said if you harbor a terrorist or train a terrorist or feed a terrorist, you're just as guilty as a terrorist, but we liberated people as well in Afghanistan. People are free in that country. Young girls now go to school for the first time in their life, thanks to the incredible compassion of the United States of America.
Do you agree with President Bush's assessment? Are women free in today's Afghanistan? And is it thanks to the compassion of the United States? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me tonight from North Hollywood, California, is Sonali Kolhatkar. She is co-director and co-founder of the Afghan Women's Mission, a U.S.-based organization working to improve the lives of women in Afghanistan. Hi, Sonali. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
And also joining me from Washington, D.C. is Belkis Akhmadi, the Afghanistan Program Coordinator for Global Rights Partners for Justice, a human rights advocacy group based in Washington. Hello, Belkis.
Hello.
Belkis, I want to start with you. You are from Afghanistan, although you left several years ago. Do you agree with President Bush that things are much better for women there now that the Taliban has been overthrown?
I think it's rather a detailed answer rather than yes or no. If you want to talk about all the changes in post-Taliban Afghanistan, I can give you a list of things that has been done. But that's not the point. The point is, when talking about women's situation in Afghanistan, we should consider two things. One is the restoration of rights that were taken away by the Taliban from women, yeah? That includes a systematic exclusion of women from public life. If we talk about those rights, that includes right to go, right to education, school, and all that, yes, those rights have been restored, at least in the cities, if not in the rural areas.
And Sonali, what are you hearing?
Well, certainly on paper, it seems as though those rights have been restored. But if you look at the latest constitution, Afghanistan now has a new constitution. And at the constitutional convention, the Loya Jirga, that took place earlier this year, on paper, it says Afghan women are equal to men, which is wonderful. This is very, very progressive. But at the last minute, there was a provision put in saying that the constitution would be undermined by Islamic Sharia law, that Islamic Sharia law would be the supreme law of the land. Well, Sharia law says, for example, that women's testimony is worth half that of men's, in effect, really undermining any kind of equality that women could have. With respect to education, for example, last November, there was a 1970s law that banned married women from the classroom, which was revived, and thousands of young Afghan women who were going to school for the first time were expelled simply because they were married. Many of them young girls who were married at a young age, many of them who were denied access to education during the years the Taliban and others were in power, who finally had the chance to go, they were expelled. And so, it's a very, very mixed situation. I would say, by and large, Afghan women have not made huge progress. The United States has made a lot of claims, but the claims ring hollow. There have been some surface changes. There have been some token instances. And as our other guests said, certainly in the cities, things are progressing. But by and large, in the rural areas, things are very bad, particularly in provinces controlled by Afghan warlords, which the United States has brought back into power.
Well, and Belkis, what do you make of these reports of women literally setting themselves on fire? I mean, these are not isolated cases. We're hearing dozens and dozens, perhaps as many as 100 in Herat and elsewhere.
Well, these are the reports that we are also receiving. There are certainly abuses and violations of women's human rights committed in the name of tradition, religion, and practices all over Afghanistan. And those are the problems that need to be addressed by the new government, by the transitional government of Afghanistan. as you said and the previous speaker mentioned, that forced marriage is a huge problem in Afghanistan. There are other problems like early marriage. Girls as young as age 7 get married in Afghanistan today.
And also these stories often have a thread of, you know, it's not just a case of, I don't want to marry this guy, but I don't want to be sold into slavery, which is essentially what is happening.
Correct. Yeah, that's true. And the other thing is exchange of women for debt release that happens in different parts of Afghanistan, trafficking of women, and problems and abuses related to polygamy.
So, Sonali, what happens if a woman is married off somewhere and the marriage is just a disaster? Can she come back home?
Absolutely not. I mean, under the current law, that's completely unthinkable. And if she did, of course, as is the case throughout many parts of South Asia, including India, where I'm originally from, and parts of Pakistan, would be a big slap in the face of the family. It would be a stain on the honor of the family. But at the same time, I think it should be noted, Afghanistan has long been a conservative society, but it didn't have to be that way. You have a governor ruling Herat, Ismail Khan, who is essentially one of the warlords brought into power by the United States. Donald Rumsfeld has met with him many, many times. In fact, has referred to him as an appealing man. Under him, there have been a rolling back of women's rights overall. And it's not just forced marriages, but issues of poverty, lack of access to education that leave women feeling so depressed that they have no choice but to commit suicide. Suicides have been commonplace even under the Taliban. And for women in a province like Herat, things have not changed very much at all compared to their lives under the Taliban. And I think we really have to look at ourselves and what the United States has pushed in Afghanistan. I mean, it really frustrates me to hear George Bush say that because of the compassionate, incredible compassion of the United States, Afghan women are now free. This is not a true statement. It's a very simplistic statement. And what it makes it seem is like, it makes it seem as though the United States went in, freed Afghan women, everything's over, we can go back home and not worry about it anymore, when in fact it's a disaster in that country. You have warlords running the country. It's very insecure. Under the United States occupation and presence in Afghanistan, Afghanistan has become, for example, the world's largest drug producer. There's so many issues to discuss here, and they're all interrelated.
Well, and also you mentioned a moment ago that many of these women are not educated, but what about the women who are? They don't seem to have much control over their lives either, and in some ways it must be even more horrifying for them because this was not how they expected their lives to turn out.
Well, if you look at the case of Malalai Joya, she was a young woman who was elected as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. She was catapulted to fame when she, in the middle of the convention, stood up and boldly pointed her finger at the warlords who were sitting in the front row and said, why have you again selected as committee chairman those criminals who have brought these disasters for the Afghan people? In my opinion, they should be taken to the world court. Well, she got applause from the other Afghans who were there, but her life was threatened. The United Nations had to provide security for her, but she became known as a national hero in Afghanistan among Afghans. And Malalai Joya spoke for many Afghans, educated and uneducated. She's a young, educated Afghan woman, and she had the courage to say something that nobody wanted to hear. So even when you have women like Malalai Joya speaking up, unfortunately, while she's reflecting what a lot of Afghan people are feeling, it's not going anywhere because you have Hamid Karzai in power with the U.S. ambassador, Zalmay Khalilzad, behind him. Incidentally, there was an interesting New York Times article about him on Saturday revealing him to be the alternative seat of power. He's a U.S. citizen. And these warlords running completely berserk in the countryside, fighting each other for power. They, in fact, there were hundreds of Afghans who were killed recently when two warlords fought it out. Their private armies are even larger than the Afghan National Army.
And Bilkis, are you hearing similar kinds of stories?
I do, yes. If I may say that what changes we see today, and it would be unfair if we say that changes have not been brought. Yes, there are changes. We see women back in public life, girls going to school, women as decision makers, women starting businesses and traveling alone and all that. These are the problems that it took probably almost 2 years to fix the problems created and imposed by the Taliban. And now those problems that have been in existence for decades and probably centuries have remained untouched. Those are the problems that we need to tackle today. And there are certain issues that the U.S. government can take an active role. For example, warlordism and Ismail Khan was mentioned, those some other warlords and local commanders who literally have taken people hostage. These are the things that the U.S. government can directly take step and disarm those people. But then to remove the problems that have been in existence for centuries, the traditional, in the name of tradition, religion, and practices, that needs time. We need to educate society. Change must come from within the society. We cannot impose it. Once people themselves are ready to bring change and they're educated enough to understand such and such practice is not right, then we can have sustainable change. Otherwise, if we outsiders, I mean, I'm an Afghan myself, and I left after the Taliban came to power. I cannot say that I'm an outsider, but living in the U.S., if I go and to a village and tell people, look, this is wrong, you should not do this, how long will that practice be stopped? Probably for 2 months, 3 months, and then they will start again. Let people be educated so they know that the practices that exist in different parts of Afghanistan are wrong and they should be stopped. And again, the government should take serious measures and steps to enact laws to forbid, to stop these acts and practices and also punish those who violate the law.
1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. To Cambridge, Massachusetts now, where Bilal is on the line. Hello and welcome.
Hi. I'd like to say I think we need to focus on religious literacy. In the cases of Turkey and Malaysia, Indonesia, and to certain extent in Iran, there's a certain freedom of religious education, which is supported by universities and which is more liberal compared to countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and so on. So I think if we the difficulties women in Afghanistan facing right now are are stemming from the practices of men who are in power, basically. So if we can introduce the understanding of religious education in these countries, such as Turkey and Iran and Indonesia and Malaysia and so on, I think we can increase the religious literacy of people in general in Afghanistan, so that women will see that Islam does not actually bring on difficulties to their lives, but indeed enriches their lives. So there is a misunderstanding of Islamic teachings in Iran, which is much more radical and extremist. And I think we have to introduce these other countries' cultures to Afghani women and men so that they'll know that, there are other countries who are Muslim as well, but women are not facing the same difficulties that Afghanis are facing today.
All right, Bilal, thanks so much for the call. Sonali, maybe a quick response. Is religious education perhaps not the whole answer, but the place to start?
No, absolutely not. I think the place to start is much simpler. The place to start is in Washington, D.C. You have Washington, D.C. arming the very men who are instituting and pushing these sorts of issues. Ismail Khan is a friend of the United States. If we want to disarm them, we can. Japan, the government of Japan, is funding a disarmament program through the United Nations. Well, we, the United States, in the 1980s, funded these men, helped fuel a civil war in the early 90s, and brought them back to power to help topple the Taliban. The simplest thing we can do is to get them off the backs of the Afghan people. Afghan people are perfectly capable of educating themselves. They just need some resources and they need to have political freedom.
I wanted to bring Charlotte Ponticelli into the conversation now. She's joining us from Baltimore, Maryland. She's Senior Coordinator for International Women's Issues at the U.S. Department of State. And Charlotte, I understand that you visited Afghanistan earlier this year with the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council, which is a State Department project. What did you find there?
Yes, thank you very much, Gail, for having me tonight. And I'm very pleased to have this opportunity, and it's an honor to appear with your other guests. I will take issue with a pat conclusion that things are a disaster in Afghanistan, particularly with respect to the situation of Afghan women. I was there at the end of February. I spent several weeks in Afghanistan, and I can state absolutely that things are better in Afghanistan now than they were a year ago, 2 years ago, and certainly a decade ago.
And how do you see that?
Well, let me tell you, if there's one message that emerged from our consultations with Afghan women themselves and also with ministers, men and women, of Afghanistan, it was this. Look how much has been accomplished in 2 years. Under the Taliban, we had nothing. And look what we have now. Let me just tell you, for example, on the political front, women are registering to vote for the first time in their lives. They're very excited about the recently concluded Loya Jirga. They're excited about having a role and a voice in the upcoming elections. On the economic front, women are starting micro-enterprises. It's slow, but it's sure. They are taking their place in the marketplace. In many respects, we do believe that the signs of progress that have occurred, thanks in large part not just to the Afghan people themselves, but to international cooperation and to the leadership of the United States, that these are positive signs and show that Afghanistan can, in fact, be a model for the rest of the world.
Charlotte, I want to ask you about one of the signs that certainly became identified in many people's minds as a symbol of what was happening there, and that was the burqa. Are many women still wearing it for their protection?
I think the burqa became a very important symbol in that it galvanized and it rallied international support for the cause of Afghan women. Right now, I think you can look at it as a piece of cloth and one that is becoming increasingly discarded. When I was in Afghanistan, and again, that was about a month and a half ago, you saw maybe 1 in 10 women wearing the burqa, where before, maybe a year ago, it was reverse. Maybe only 1 in 10 did not wear the burqa. It's a symbol, but it's not the be-all and the end-all. As Mr. Brahimi pointed, following his stint in Afghanistan representing the United Nations.
All right. We're going to continue our discussion in just a moment. We're talking this hour about women in post-Taliban Afghanistan. How much headway have they made? Is it enough? A good start or a disappointment? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the status of women in today's Afghanistan and what role the U.S. should play. What is America's responsibility to Afghan women today? Are we meeting it? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking tonight with Sonali Kolhatkar, co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission. Also with us are Belkiz Ahmadi, Afghanistan Program Coordinator for Global Rights, Partners for Justice, and Charlotte Ponticelli, Senior Coordinator for International Women's Issues at the U.S. State Department. And Belkiz, I want to throw the burqa question to you as well. Again, it's such a powerful symbol of how women are treated in Afghanistan. Do you see women freely dumping their burqas, and is there a difference in terms of how women are reacting in Kabul versus out in the countryside, which is presumably much more conservative?
I have been to Afghanistan 6 or 7 times since the fall of the Taliban, and I would like to back what Charlotte just said, that last year around this time, I could only see probably 1 or 2 out of 10 women without burqas in the cities, in Kabul, Mazar. But I was there in February and March. And this time I saw probably 1 or 2 with burqas out of 10 in Afghanistan. And again, the important thing about this whole book, I think, is that it's not imposed by state. Even if you see women, it's probably their own choice.
Well, is it their own choice because they want to wear it or because there are people who will frown at them if they don't?
It goes back to men's mentality. Men's mentality have changed now. Men have become more conservative. And also, when we go outside Kabul, it's also related to the warlords, to the fear of being abducted and kidnapped by the local commanders and gunmen.
And Sonali, what's your thought on this?
Well, I think the issue of the burqa may be a little bit of a distraction. And, you know, I'm not Afghan. I haven't been to Afghanistan. I've studied it very closely and I work very closely with Afghan women. But I think one more important indicator of what's happening in Afghanistan is the fact that just in the last few days, the Afghan province of Nangarhar has banned women entertainers and women reporters from performing on television and radio, saying that it was un-Islamic, which is, again, very problematic. And most shockingly, of course, it's reminiscent of Taliban style laws. So I think we're going to see a complete lapse, maybe not in the organized way that we did under the Taliban, but one by one, province by province, into the kind of fundamentalist ideology that the Taliban had put forward. The difference this time is that it's being put forward by people that we helped, that we supported, that we enlisted against the Taliban. And I'd like to, you know, I'd like to also react a little bit to Charlotte Ponticelli's issue with women voting. There was this very shocking quote that Hamid Karzai made on March 8th, International Women's Day, where he basically said he tried to encourage Afghan men to let their women go out and vote and register to vote. He said, you know, go on and let her register to vote. Later on, you can control who she votes for. And I'm not joking. He said this, and it was not reported in the press, but it really reflects at the highest level, at the government level, what Afghan women are facing. On top of that, only 4 to 15% of them, at least according to the last polls done many years ago, are even literate. How are they supposed to read a ballot? They are facing issues of poverty, survival, of homelessness, joblessness, day-to-day issues that go far beyond the kind of clothes they wear and are forced to wear. Certainly, the freedom to wear whatever clothing they want is an important one. But I think Afghan women are trying to survive, especially outside Kabul. And as far as I've read in Herat, most Afghan women do wear burqas. Maybe my information is wrong, but perhaps Charlotte and Balkis can confirm whether in provinces, rural parts of the country, we do see only 1 in 10 Afghan women wearing the burqa. As far as I understand it, it's still prevalent. But again, it's probably a distraction to harp on that for too long.
Hmm. So maybe a quick response, Charlotte. Were you able to get out in the countryside on your trip?
Yes, we were able to go out to Bagram province. We visited a provincial reconstruction team. And these PRTs, as they are called, are doing just an incredible job with reconstruction, spreading it out from the center to the provinces. It's going to be a long process, but they are building not only in terms of infrastructure, but in terms of building trust and working with the local authorities and working with the populations to help them help themselves. And I really appreciate Sonali's admission that she has not been in Afghanistan, because if you have, and particularly in recent days, you can see visible signs of progress, including in the provinces. Sonali talks about Herat, for example. It's interesting that in Herat, I believe that 43% of the registered voters thus far are women. And that is, again, a measurable, tangible sign of success. And thanks in large part to the leadership of the United States with our coalition partners, with the international partners we have.
1-800-423-8255 is our number. To Belmont, Massachusetts now, Shabnam is on the line. Hello.
Hi. I just like to, one of your guests, I think, was making the point that part of the problem is that Islamic law is sort of going to supersede any other laws in Afghanistan. But I think the problem that one of the other callers made was that the women in Afghanistan don't know what their rights are under Islam. if they knew what their rights were under Islam, then they could stand up to their husbands, their mother-in-laws, their fathers, or whoever, and say that this is what I'm guaranteed under Islam, and I don't have to be so, I cannot be sold into marriage. I am not your slave, or any of those things. Because let me just give you an example. The rights that are guaranteed by Islam for women are the guaranteed rights of inheritance. No woman can be married without her consent. The woman has a right to divorce. The woman has a right to own her property, whether she's married or unmarried, and especially when she's married. This is a right that American women did not have until 1890.
So you're saying these are things that the Afghan women should know as well?
Let me just she has a right to her own earnings, whether she's unmarried or married. And this is under all the laws of all the different schools of Islam. So within a marriage, the only thing that she owes her husband is sex, nothing else, not her labor, nothing. She does not owe any labor to her husband, to her mother-in-law. She cannot be sold. And, all these things that are in Afghanistan are because women do not know their rights under Islam. And Islam, if you look at any other culture, women have to bring a dowry to be married. Islam is the only one where the man has to give her, not her father, give her a reverse dowry for the privilege of marrying her.
Okay, Shabnam, I have to stop you. You're making a lot of good points, and I want to have a chance to hear from either Sonali or Bilqis.
Sonali, you want to go ahead?
Well, let me just make a quick point. I mean, I think it's great what she said, but I think more importantly than educating women about their rights would be the establishment of a secular democracy in Afghanistan, where religion is separated from government. If it's good enough for us here in the United States, it ought to be good enough for the Afghan people. The group I work with, RAWA, very much has been espousing this since 1977, because what do you do when a man with a gun says, well, actually, no, my copy of the Quran says that that women do not have these rights, and so I'm going to tell you that Islamic law is this. At some level, it's going to be a matter of faith, one person's word against the other. But if you completely separate religion from government, no matter what religion it is, we don't want Christianity in our religion here. Why should Afghans have to live with any kind of Islamic law, a progressive interpretation or a regressive one in their government?
To Hamid now, who's on the line from Greenville, North Carolina. Hello, Hamid, and welcome.
Thank you very much for giving me a chance to make some points. Since last 35 years that I witnessed the destruction of Afghanistan, especially in last 6 or 7 years under Taliban regime, you all know that nothing is left from infrastructure in Afghanistan. So first thing I want to make the point that rebuilding of Afghanistan is not easy and will be a false expectation if we expect that the new regime or whoever goes to Afghanistan to rebuild Afghanistan within less than a decade. The second thing I know from experience to establishment of democracy in other parts of the world, that in order to establish democracy, economy, education, agriculture, building the country will not bring democracy. For establishment of democracy, we have to look at the Constitution of the United States and read the history of democracy in this country, and then we learn that security is number one requirement.
All right, Hamid.
Right now,
hold on.
Right now.
Need to stop you there. Appreciate the phone call and the points you made, and I want to ask Bilqis. I mean, it sounds as if what Hamid is saying is, listen, there are so many problems there. Maybe women's issues are going to need to stay on the back burner for a while.
I would disagree with it. I think women's promotion of women's human rights can go parallel to all the other problems that we are trying to fix now in Afghanistan. And we have to realize that the path to democracy is full of challenges. Now Afghanistan is becoming a democratic state. So we have to recognize and realize that we're going to have challenges. And the important thing is that the Afghan people, the civil society, they are committed, and I'm sure they will overcome those challenges. And I agree that changes cannot be brought overnight. For God's sake, we have had 25 years of war, and we cannot fix everything in 2 years, 2 years. It took us more than 2 years to fix or to undo what the Taliban did. But the psychological effect is going to stay for a long time. And that's what we need to focus on.
And Charlotte, I want to put the question to you that Bernard Henri Levy posed earlier in the program as to whether Westerners are responsible, especially responsible here, and particularly whether they are promising more than can be delivered. What would be your answer to him?
Well, I think he, first of all, I think that Bernard Levy wrote a beautiful article in the New York Times. But I think that we should not overlook the bottom line of his story, which he repeated tonight on your show. And that is, this is an exhortation to do more. And as far as promises, no one can ever promise that democracies can be built overnight. And I would agree with my friend Belkis, whom I met for the first time last week in Washington. Democracies don't begin and end with a constitution. They don't begin and end with elections. It took a long process for Afghanistan to get where it was at the fall of the Taliban. And it's going to be a long process ahead. And I think especially the women of Afghanistan not only are capable and willing of meeting that challenge, that's what they tell us. They know that the democratic process for them has just begun. The women that I work with from Afghanistan and have worked with in Afghanistan are very strong about telling us we know that the road has just begun, that now we have to work for implementation of the Constitution and we have to work for legal reform. The programs that the United States government has funded, that the United States of America can be proud of, and that we have paid for a very dear price in terms of taxpayer dollars and in terms of American lives that have been given to the cause of the people of Afghanistan, already are yielding tangible results. They are planting the seeds for the future. There is great hope in terms of the people of Afghanistan, and including and perhaps especially its women, who are a great resource for the country. And increasingly, the men of Afghanistan are realizing this. From the leadership, from President Karzai on down.
Charlotte, let me stop you there for a moment. I want to hear just one more time briefly from Sonali as to what will have to happen there for you to say real progress has been made.
It's very simple, and I'd like to ask Charlotte Ponticelli, if she, this question. Why is the United States supporting, why did the United States enlist in men who are just as fundamentalist as the Taliban, these Afghan warlords, the Northern Alliance, the Mujahideen, who destroyed Kabul from 1992 to 1996 when 40,000 Afghans were killed? My question, if the United States were to completely back off from these men who are terribly destructive to Afghanistan, allow real democracy to flourish, not create a situation where the only outcome of the election is Hamid Karzai, which is essentially what's happening. If you read the New York Times article on Saturday about Zalmay Khalilzad, would that be possible? If
Sonali,
that were to happen, I would think there would be progress in Afghanistan.
We're going to have to leave that as a rhetorical question. I thank all three of you so much for being with us, Sonali Kolhatkar, Belkis Ahmadi, and Charlotte Ponticelli. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.